Welcome to this podcast of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club of California, by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at www.commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. You can also find Inforum on Facebook, MySpace, and LinkedIn.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club's Inforum. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. I'm Scott Schaefer, host of KQED Public Radio's Statewide California Report. And tonight we are joined by Gavin Newsom, and as you may know, Gavin was elected mayor of San Francisco in 2003, one of the youngest people ever elected to that job. Re-elected 4 years later, easily, and then during his second term was elected lieutenant governor of California, a position he's held since January. His top priorities there include economic development and job creation, and that means we've got plenty to talk about. So let's get started. Let's welcome Gavin Newsom.
Thanks again, guys. Thank you. Is there a politician that's top priority is not jobs and economic development? Maybe that's the first
thing to talk
about.
It's actually your portfolio, though.
Yeah, though it is substantively. It's spelled out as one of the formal roles of lieutenant governor, chair of the Economic Development Commission. You serve on the UC Board of Regents, CSU Board of Trustees. And perhaps most significantly, and this is something most folks don't know, there is something called the State Lands Commission, which is just three people. The lieutenant governor serves as its chair every other year. I happen to be chair of state lands. And the reason that matters is that everything to do with state property, from rivers, lakes, to 3 miles off the coast, issues related to oil extraction, mineral extraction, if you care about offshore oil drilling, it's state lands that ultimately determines that fate and that future. And so it is a remarkably important role that the lieutenant governor plays in that respect, and it's one of the more enlivening parts of the job.
So you rather famously said, "I have no idea what the lieutenant governor does." So
I know you figured that out. Yeah. Once again, I learned you can't. You know, it is amazing. I said it with a big smile on my face the first time, and you know, no one takes
that got
it.
Fed back.
Well,
to
my
it.
Opponent made sure to feed that back. He doesn't even know when he's running. This is. You know, the irony of that, Scott, is I graduated, not surprisingly, from Santa Clara University with a political science major. Part of the responsibility, or rather requirement, to get the major was to do an internship. And who did I intern for but then Lieutenant Governor Leo McCarthy, here in San Francisco at the State Building right across the street from City Hall. So not only did I know academically, I actually knew directly what the Lieutenant Governor did. And I'll be honest, if you know, you look back, and it's not a critique of any of the previous lieutenant governors that I didn't mention, but it's really an appreciation of that lieutenant governor, Leo McCarthy. He was just a decent human being, a remarkable figure in California politics, ubiquitous in terms of the city and county of San Francisco, sort of a great Jesuit, very Socratic, very interested in learning, and was a great mentor and model. And so in so many respects, I look back for inspiration to what Leo did or what would Leo do.
Yeah, genuinely nice man.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So let's talk about jobs a little bit. I want to talk about other things as well. Tonight the president spoke. I don't know if you heard the whole speech. Is there anything he could really do or say at this point that he either shouldn't have done 3 years ago? I mean, he is 3 years into it now, and he's talking about jobs. What can he say, or what should he have said that he can't really say because of politics?
Oh, God bless. No, I mean, by any objective analysis, I think people felt very good about the tone and tenor of the speech. They said he may have come across a little aggressively, but I felt he needed to. Now he's going to follow up with the details, right? It was a little of the sizzle, and the steak's going to follow up, and he made that point in the next few weeks that will give him the ability to go out in the campaign trail, so to speak, on it. Look, you know, someone reminded me today, I was with, and there's such a thing, and boy, is it a small group, as the Democratic Lieutenant Governors Association, and they happen to be in town today. And again, it's a small group. We really did have a bad election. It wasn't just Congress, the last election cycle. We got hit hard in state houses. But one of the folks there was a policy director on the campaign, and he reminded all of us that were there that the president, one of the first things he did as president was hold a job summit, an economic summit. And it spawned a conversation of how many similar conversations he's had with American people about jobs. It's just happened sporadically. It's happened, you know, this month and then this got in the way and that month. There hasn't been sort of a strong, cohesive narrative. Other things always sort of crowded out the jobs agenda, understandably.
Do you think he made a mistake going with healthcare before trying to fix the economy?
Of course, from a political frame. But an historic frame, when you look at the narrative of our lives and our time, no. And he did exactly what he said he was going to do. No one could critique him. He said this was my priority, so this was our moment in time. He made those commitments publicly. Debated them in the primary, debated them in the general election, and did what he actually said he was going to do, which is in and of itself remarkable, that a politician actually does what they say they were going to do. Sure, we didn't get a public option. I would have preferred that. Sure, we didn't get the kind of reforms from a cost control perspective that I think are necessary to make this reform ultimately effective and resonate, but that was an extraordinary moment in time. And again, let's just disassociate ourselves from this moment in time. I think we'll look back 20, 30, 50, 100 years, and it will be a remarkable accomplishment indeed. And I think he's on the right track now in the economy, but we've got a lot of work to do.
You know, there's a lot of Democrats who are frustrated with him because they feel like he hasn't championed their particular issue enough. Environmentalists are not happy.
It was not a good week last week.
And, you know, Latinos, gay community is pretty happy with Don't Ask, Don't Tell about to go away. But, you know, there's this question of whether he's been confrontational enough or has he been too accommodating. I think, was it Maureen Dowd called him the deferrer in chief?
Yeah.
What do you think of that? Was he naive in thinking that he could sort of meet the Republicans in the middle?
I love that. Of course he was. But you know what? Such is the nature of change. Sometimes doesn't always work out as it was intended, but you know, I've always subscribed to the beginner's mind, the Roger Bannister theory of life. You remember Roger Bannister was the one who broke the 4-minute mile because he didn't pay attention to the experts. He didn't know what he didn't know. He actually believed it was possible. And as a consequence, it was, and dozens of people around the world that same year broke the 4-minute mile after human history. No one had ever done it. And so I like that. I think that's what we all aspired in terms of our own. He was the whiteboard, and we wrote our own image. We had Republicans support him, independents, Democrats, and he came in, yes, with that naivete, believing he could change things, and not just the players, but the game. Remember the rhetoric around that. And I still hope he has that, hardened by reality, hard-headed now by pragmatism, but I still hope he has that, and I don't think that's a negative by any stretch. I think he's got out of his way to try to accommodate, and he hasn't been there 7 years. He hasn't been there one term. He just got here. I mean, it's an extraordinary thing. We act as if, he's just failed us. It's unbelievable, you know, in every respect. I mean, this guy is a disaster. I've given up. He's been there 2.5 years. And he did suffer one of the great crises in modern American presidency on so many different levels. And he's handled it, I think, remarkably with grace and with elan. And we're, I think, sort of leaning the right direction. I'm not happy about the ozone decision last week or the pipeline decision. I'm not happy about gay marriage. I don't believe in running the 9-yard dash on civil rights. I'm not happy about a lot of things, but I'm also happy about other things. Expansion of Pell Grants. I'm happy he stepped up and stepped in at a time of crisis in this country and asserted himself and put himself on the line and made tough choices. I'm happy in hindsight at what he did in the automobile industry. I'm happy at what he certainly did on Don't Ask, Don't Tell and DOMA finally and other things. And I think he's moving the right direction on a lot of the EPA rules and regulations. He asserted himself on cap and trade, didn't get everything we want, but is working in other ways to address that. And I think there's sincerity in his desire to work across lines and sincerity to try to bring people together. And I think he's a decent human being, and he's learning. Yeah. And so that's my
You've come
guy.
Around on him, because you're a big Hillary person.
Oh, I was.
And I remember talking
still
to you
am.
At the Democratic Convention, and you were
I'm a big Hillary. But it doesn't mean I'm not an Obama person. It just means, I don't want to overstate it, but I'm fairly close with President Clinton. He was very helpful getting me elected mayor. You may recall, he came out. Al Gore was out for weeks, and then President Clinton came out when I was running against Supervisor Matt Gonzalez, and I've gotten to know him from a policy perspective. We go to CGI, his Clinton Global Initiative, every year. We did a lot of partnerships when I'm mayor, not not a lot got attention, but we developed that framework, and I believe in the power of ideas. You may disagree with his tactics, et cetera, but President Clinton's one of those people that is another lifelong learner. He's always seeking to understand before he's understood, and I just admire people like that. Again, I'm not going to get into the morality of issues, or we can talk welfare reform or triangulation, but I've long admired him, and Hillary is an extraordinary human being with extraordinary talents, and I think has proven herself against extraordinary odds and has done herself and this country great service. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about your transition from mayor. You've been lieutenant governor now, 9 months or so? You went from being the top dog.
I know.
With to being
number
sort of
50.
Sort of being the political equivalent of Barry Zito. You know, all suited up.
Oh, man,
all suited up. You know, you're
just
not
without
injured.
Without the contract. That's the difference. Yeah.
No, if only you were making 60 million.
I know. I'm left-handed.
But how tough is it? You played baseball, too, didn't you?
Yeah, right.
You could have been.
That hurts, the Zito comment.
I'm sorry. We'll say Freddie Sanchez.
No, all right. Good.
No, but my point being, and you knew this going for it, lieutenant governor, it's one of those jobs that really, you don't really have to do anything. I mean, you've got a portfolio.
Yeah, you don't.
No, you don't.
It's legit. Yeah, no, but I'm not that person. I'm not going to just sit around. I don't want to rust out. I'd rather wear out.
Sure.
I'd rather exhaust everyone else's patience. This is really way too much information. But, I got out of college and I started delivering orthotics for ProLab Orthotics in Burlingame. It wasn't necessarily what my parents had in mind. It was a good job. But I realized I could do more and got my real estate license because I was a pretty good delivery boy because I finished early and I went to Anthony's out there on Park Presidio when I was out there and got my real estate license and went down to Walter Shorenstein's office because he was a big real estate guy and begged for a job and I got one for $17,600 at 235 Montgomery Street at the Russ Building. And then I started showing up when everyone else showed up at 8:59, and I started leaving when everyone else was leaving at 4:59. And I realized that's not my life. The 9-to-5 is just not my life. As much my admire Walter and his company, it's an extraordinary company. I'm close to the family. It just wasn't everything. So at 22, 23, decided to go out on my own and try to create something. Came pen to paper, came up with an idea for a little wine store, Plump Jack. Got one part-time employee, Pat Kelly. Borrowed $7,500 from my father and got 13 other people to give me $7,500. And it was a disaster. It took 2.5 years.
I thought there was a happy ending
there.
No.
And it was the great gift of all times. I mean, I almost was shut down. I had to make it work. I had to try new things. It was a great struggle. And we were able to evolve that to a restaurant a few years later, and now we have 17 businesses, close to 1,000 people we employ. And I say that not to impress you, but to make this point and to impress upon you this point. There's an entrepreneurial gene I have. There's a desire to be a little more audacious, to take risks, being willing to fail, learn from my mistakes, as they say, increase the number of tries. And so I walked into politics with that same orientation. And I think I've demonstrated it in things that you liked, things you may not have liked. You may not have liked Care Not Cash. Trust me, that was an audacious thing at the time. You may not have liked gay marriage. It was an audacious thing even at this time. And I tried to do things differently. And I learned from my mistakes. I made them. And I want to continue to make them. So I'm in a job where I don't want to be predictable. I'm in a job where I don't want to be like everybody else. I'm in a job that I do want to stake out a different claim. And I do believe that people can reinvent positions, not just themselves. And I'm trying to do that. And I hope I've demonstrated that in the first 6 months on some of the work we've done on a jobs and competitiveness plan that I would argue is among the most substantive plans. I didn't write it, but I hired some of the best people to write it that is out there that I think hopefully distinguishes my time and justifies some of your financial contribution to my salary.
Yeah. You know, I actually, as you were talking, I thought of a better analogy than the Barry Zito. Your secretariat. You're in the stable. You know, you're in the stable. You started running.
We got to edit the audio. Start with that.
You started running with the jobs thing. You were building on the economic competitiveness. And then a few weeks ago, the governor sort of decided that was going to be his portfolio.
Yes,
he appointed Michael Rossi to be his job czar.
Yep.
He had a press conference today, bipartisan press conference.
Yeah,
you weren't there, I noticed.
That was fabulous.
So what's going on there with that relationship? I mean, typically...
He's the governor, I'm not. And I get it. He's the governor. And it's what he should be doing. And
really?
It's what he's doing. We recommended he do a job. Sorry, I did it. Recommended that he support a new economic development agency, and I believe he'll be signing a bill in the next 24 hours that will create a new economic development agency in the state that I've been working on with the speaker for a year. I believe he'll support our efforts to reconstitute a commerce office in the state, a state that had a trade and commerce office up until 2003, at a time when, yes, the world was flat and the world became increasingly globalized and we were coming to grips with it. We shut down all our offices overseas and we have no representation overseas, where almost every state, in fact, I know of 32 states that have foreign offices, Pennsylvania 22, that don't cost the taxpayers money, that assert a global framework to their states from a manufacturing and exports perspective. I believe he'll support the efforts in China that we're about to announce and some of the other recommendations in our plan. So, look, I care, and I think you care, not about the personalities, but about the progress. I don't think anyone cares about rhetoric around, the talking points. People care about outcomes now, and so I care about that because at the end of the day, people aren't going to judge me on whether or not Jerry Brown took an idea or Jerry Brown this or that or I did this. They're going to judge us on whether or not we were part of the state of California's recovery. And my plan, just quickly, Scott, is not about getting us back so that we're sustainable. It's about getting us back to our greatness. I mean, that's the plan. California has always been about greatness. We've not been about being better than average. I mean, this state has always been on the leading and cutting edge. A quick fact, and this is important to the whole jobs focus. We have a structural problem, not just in the state, but this country, that is profoundly important to appreciate. It's not Lehman Day, September 15th, 2008, that alarms me when the macroeconomic realities that we're facing today became more acute in the downturn. It's what's happened in the last 30 years in this state, in the country, that should scare you more and scare me more. Between 1950 and 1980, this state was great in every way, shape, or form. From a jobs perspective, we grew a job growth on an annual basis of 3.7%, the nation at 2.2%. We substantially outperformed the rest of the nation in job creation. But since 1980 to 2010, these numbers came out in March, we have flatlined at 1.1%, and the nation has gone down about 1.2%. We've actually become a little bit below average.
So what changed?
A 30-year trend. So many things. One, education. Two, innovation economy was impacted by that. Three, our manufacturing base. And as a consequence, those three pillars, we're holding up a vibrant middle class that's now been gutted. And unless we reconcile the education issue, that will feed our innovative spirit, that will bring back manufacturing, it is not paper and perks that made California great. It was people and products. Unless we go back to that frame, then we won't be great again. And our plan speaks to that spirit. It speaks to at least a sense of pride that I have being a fifth-generation Californian, and it speaks to a specific agenda, 38 items, small as getting a patent office in California. There is not one, even though the world's majority of patents come out of this state, to as significant as dramatically changing our regulatory environment.
You mentioned 1980, and you know there are a lot of things that happened around that time, but in 1978, Prop 13 passed,
yeah.
And that changed a lot of things.
Yeah.
Do you think that's part of it?
I think it's part of it, but I think it's too easy. You know, I'm one of those guys, you know, a good Democrat, Reagan, I get blamed for everything. Now it's Bush. It's just easier. We used to do it on the homeless issue. You know, I still maintain this as my great passion in life, the issue of homelessness and poverty. It was Reagan who shut down all the institutions and left it, except it wasn't necessarily accurate. It was the Supreme Court. It was the whole movement against institutionalization. It was the advent of lithium and thorazine and psychotropic drugs where people didn't necessarily need to be institution. What Reagan did is he didn't fund the community-based care. He didn't fund the alternative to the institutions. But it came from the left, not just the right, to move away from that model of coercive care, et cetera. And so in life, it's difficult. It's good sometimes, back to my point, to not know certain things. Because then there's purity of your cause. But then again, that's ideology, isn't it? And all ideology gets in the way of progress. And so I'm a guy, and that's one of the things that always inspired me about Clinton. Again, whether you like him or not, he always spoke to the point of being open to argument, interested in evidence. And that's why I went to Texas. It was a bitter pill for Democrats up there in Sacramento to take. They're still criticizing me because I had the audacity to go to Texas.
With a group of Republicans.
With a group of 14 Republicans. With the guy who wrote Prop 23 to overturn AB 32. Dan Logue. I mean, this is for everything I'm about and a lot of us here in the Bay Area about are exact opposite of what Dan's about.
Just for those who may not know, that's the global warming.
Global warming. Bill. To roll back, you know, we have AB 32 is to roll back our greenhouse gas emissions to 1990 levels by 2020. And it sets us apart from almost any other state and gives me faith and confidence about our future as long as we harness the opportunity to change the way we produce and consume energy. And he wanted to overturn it. It was Valero and Tesoro, two big Texas-based oil companies that helped fund this initiative. And you were wise enough to overwhelmingly defeat it, and it was an important point in time in our state's history. It will be as we implement AB 32. My point of this, I'm open to argument. And I'm sick and tired of hearing about Rick Perry this, Rick Perry that. You know, he's coming in casing our joints. He was coming into California on what he called hunting trips to hunt for jobs. I heard about the fact that Austin, Texas, the city of Austin, and their Chamber of Commerce was opening an office in Southern California. Think about that. The audacity. But how aggressive they are, not just were in job creation. And you know what? I thought there's something we can learn about that. It may be low-wage jobs. It may have more minimum-wage jobs. Maybe more people uninsured there as a percentage than any other big state.
Well, and they have very much less environmental regulation.
And they may have not as clean air and much clean water, but that doesn't dismiss the fact that they may not have good public-private partnerships about job creation and support and retention. It may not mean they don't have a good marketing strategy or plan, or it may not be a bad idea that Rick Perry does this. He sends now iPads with videos of how wonderful it is to do business in Texas to CEOs all across the country. I mean, I don't think that's a bad idea to market yourself, to get back into the game. They have an economic development agency. California doesn't. They're asserting themselves. They're creating perceptions that change people's attitudes. They're out there. They're trying to recruit us. Here in California, good luck. I mean, we're not in the game. So that's why I went. But I'll go anywhere. I'll go to see Haley Barbour in Mississippi. I'll see Bobby Jindal in Louisiana. Not just my friends in, you know, Connecticut and Maryland and in Massachusetts. And I think we have to do that in this country, not just this state. We've got to disabuse ourselves that we have all the answers and we're exclusive in our, you know, I don't know, whatever, perspective and perception.
You know, one of the things that characterizes San Francisco and maybe the Bay Area to a certain extent is the political correctness here. And there is, you know, we say we want...
You must wear clothes to sit naked on a bench.
Well, I was going to ask you about that.
Important issues.
I want to ask you about your position
on
public nudity.
It's not just circumcision bans any longer. I admit I went by McDonald's and thought of Happy Meal today.
What is your... Well, now you brought it up.
What is
your position on public nudity, so to speak?
I didn't know one had to have a position.
Seated or standing?
I guess, rear, not frontal. I guess is my position. Sorry, that was really... I don't have... Well, you know, this is an aside, but, you know, we had to... I was mayor when we had to go through all the strife and travails around the Beta Breakers.
Right.
And I grew up going to the Beta Breakers. And as a kid, my mom always said, and you know, it was just part of the quirkiness of the great city in San Francisco. And I moved to the Hate, so I was there in the Panhandle and everyone going crazy. So I get earful from everyone. I walk in the streets. And, you know, we had to turn things around. And, you know, I got a little concerned that we were going to clamp down, too much on certain aspects that made it unique. And so we had a public policy and we had a private policy. I should just leave it at that. Just to try to, you just don't want to sanitize things too much. You want to move in the right direction, but keep people safe. We had to clamp down on the drinking. That was important. And we had a much more successful event this year. And last year was a little more successful than the year before, moving in the right direction. But I do think the quirkiness is what makes San Francisco a special place. So I kind of like these debates.
Yeah.
I'm not a
fan. But you don't miss being in the middle of them, I suspect.
No, I miss that. Of course.
Do you really?
It's fun, yeah. I mean, it's what makes life worth living.
So why did you move to Ross?
I'm in my parents-in-law house because they're gone for the summer because I sold my house because I needed, I had a new baby. I mean, you guys all know about that. None of you know about my economic development plan. I mean, it's truly, you really can't make this stuff up, but, it is what it is. So, I'll let you know when I'm back, but it's trivial.
You still vote here?
Yeah, I can't vote there because I get my mail here, my business are here, and I'm moving back here. I'd be arrested there, so I don't know what to do.
Yeah.
They kicked me off, that whatever guy.
Central Committee.
They kicked me off. Yeah, he must have felt great. He had probably went out to dinner, a drink. Hey, we got rid of him. Let's get on to things that matter, and these are the sideshows. I mean, the quirkiness is fine as long as it doesn't get in the way of things that matter to you.
Yeah.
As much as these are fun. I mean, I get why Us Weekly sells. I mean, it's not just Kardashian wedding photos. We need it. It's a stressful life. I mean, so you need a little happy meal, controversy. You need to read on the front page above the fold, huge headlines with pictures of Scott Wiener, the nudity thing. I mean, I don't know if that deserved to be on the front page of the paper as the most important story, but it makes life more fun.
Yeah, yeah. What, you mentioned the mayor's race.
I did.
Yeah, I think you did. That was before the official program started.
Oh, yeah.
There is a mayor's race here. What do you make of it? A lot of people running.
Yeah, it's a quiet one.
It is. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, why is that, do you think?
You know, it's interesting. When I was running, by this time you knew by this time, if you go back to my first mayor's race, you had all my tax returns, and they were front page headline. You know what my income was every year. You knew every one of my business investors, and there were profiles on them. You knew all about my mother, my father. You knew all about everyone I had ever associated with. You had vetting of all the people that were writing me checks. It was pretty impressive.
It was a much smaller field.
It was, I mean, there was Susan Leal, Angela Alio.
Yeah,
these weren't lightweights.
True.
These were serious problems. There were a lot more people than people remember. It's just very different. Now it was very quiet for 6-9 months, and now, we got to catch up. But you're never going to catch up to really vet all these candidates. And I think what's unfortunate that is the unfairness that is for all the other candidates that don't have incumbency next to their name. Because the advantage goes squarely to the incumbent in this situation. And what happens is it's hard for the others to get attention. So you tend to be a little more radical in some of your points of view just to get attention. We're going to get rid of the central subway or something. It's just not a good idea.
Dennis Rode.
Yeah, and I like Dennis. It just that's not a good idea. And I worked my tail off to get it to a point where we're about to announce a full funding grant agreement to get close to $1 billion from the federal government. By the way, they can't redirect that money. There's this myth that, we wouldn't do that project, but we'd use that money for something else. It doesn't exist. The money goes away. So don't buy that argument. It's made up. But I understood it from a political frame.
They want to distinguish themselves.
You got it. It's tough right now. Ed's he's a very smart guy. He's doing a good job. And I feel great because, the Twitter deal, it was, 6 months we worked. I mean, I'm not good, but it was nice. It's continuation. He's out there, the Hope Six stuff, he supports it. Care Not Cash, he supports. So I should feel great about it because he's sort of maintaining a direction and course, but with a different personality, which was refreshing, right? We need that after a few years, because you guys, I was sick of me. Every day in the paper, just news and this, that, president. You just go, oh, God, And so it's nice to, as Obama said, turn the page and get a breather.
Yeah.
And so you have that breather now, and it's doing a good job, but there's some good candidates as well.
Yeah. Let me ask you about that, because there was a lot of conflict between you and the board, and a lot of it was due to people like Chris Daley, Aaron Peskin. It was very combative. There was a sense that, no, it was.
I think it was wildly overplayed, but I'm with you.
Yeah.
I just think truly wildly overplayed.
By who?
We love controversy. We love the quick slap, the slight. Once a week someone says something nasty and it becomes then the news story when everything for 6 days, everyone was working together and we passed 28 bills together, we passed a budget, 10-1. It's so wild how things are disproportionately pulled out.
Mm-hmm.
So I never bought it. People say, boy, it must have been disappointing you couldn't get everything you wanted done because the Board of Supervisors said it's just not true. I'll take responsibility and accountability for what I did and didn't do. But the board may have sometimes made it more difficult. But we worked around, went to the ballot, got things, and we eventually got things. That may have been more. So I don't buy that. Healthy controversy is the hallmark of healthy change.
Yeah. Looking back on it, though, I mean, even Sean Elsburn, who you appointed to the you appointed him to the board, said, you know, I don't forget the exact phrase he used, but it's like a breath of fresh air, and not a reflection on you necessarily, but there was a new board
after the
election, and it was just much more collaborative, and there was a sense, until Ed announced he was running.
Which
is a big deal.
That's
a big deal. But looking back on that, do you think there was something you did to contribute to it?
Oh, of course. Yeah, I mean, but by definition, because I was a participant. But you got to understand, you're running for election. It's the old adage, dogs don't bark at parked cars. Dogs don't bark at parked cars. You know, if I just sat back and said, you know, hey, you know, Daley, you're right, I'm wrong. Hey, we'll go with that. We're de-appropriate police and fire. Was it $90 million? No big deal. We should cut half the police force. You're right. He'd go, man, this guy. And Daley would come out and say, you know, this guy's really a good collaborator. This Newsom guy's working well with us. You know, sometimes you need to step up and step in to move things. Maybe when you're handing out $400 a month in cash and you have more people dying every single year and you actually see more people on the street suffering, maybe we needed a pattern interrupt that interrupted our own pattern of belief that more is not always better, that money is not a solution to every problem. By just handing out money, you're not going to solve a problem. Maybe you needed to get in that controversial debate. You're going to rub people the wrong way. And so I don't regret those fights. For me, they weren't personality driven. They were policy. And we had fundamental differences of policy and a lot of issues. And I thought that was healthy. And you know, I think a lot of those things, I feel very good about some of those wins. And I feel like those losses will be recognized. I mean, when we tried to do Wi-Fi in the city, we'd be on our sixth incarnation of that. You know, I don't mind losing that, but I like the battle. And it created a lot of controversy with members of the board. You don't need to remember these things, but there's a lot of friction. And so I don't think it's inherently a bad thing. I didn't go to get along just to get along. So everyone says, boy, everyone's getting along and the city's moving in the wrong direction. I wanted to kind of keep leaning in. And it didn't mean I was always right, but I didn't regret that. But I absolutely contributed to it by inherent nature of my being.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I was the mayor vetoing their legislation. I had different points of view on the budget. I was fighting for things they didn't support, some of them.
Yeah. One of the criticisms of you is that you have a short attention span, I'm actually surprised by that. Really? Well, I mean that you were...
I got better critiques of me than that one.
Okay, well, we'll get to that. But, you know, that you were on the board and you wanted to become mayor and then you wanted to become governor. That didn't work, so then you wanted to become lieutenant governor. And, you know, I suspect you want to be president one day.
Oh, God, no.
Really?
No, but I, you know, it's interesting. It's interesting the way you frame it. I mean, I spent 7 years on the board. I don't know how short that attention span was. I spent 7 years as mayor, I don't know how short that attention span was. I was termed out as a board member, I think. I think I'd served out my terms and I basically termed out as mayor. But I love public policy. You know, I come from the private sector, as I noted to you. That's why the jobs issue to me is I'm passionate about it. I mean, I know what a P&L is. I know what depreciation schedules or balance sheets are. I've signed the front of paychecks, not just the back. And I do think, you know, I think that matters intuitively. It doesn't mean you're smarter or better, but it's not intellectual to me. It's visceral. You know, when someone puts something on the line and their family puts everything on the line and they do a line of credit on their house and I admire that. And that's not a Democrat or Republican thing. And I kind of think the Democratic Party in some way, though, has lost a little of that. I mean, we should be the entrepreneurial party. That's the spirit. That's the middle class. That's our diverse communities coming in from Vietnam, opening up a small restaurant. That's the spirit of America, the spirit that has brought us here and made us what we are. I think Democrats should reclaim that. But I ran for governor because I wanted to be governor.
Yeah.
And I thought I would offer something. I fell short of that, and I don't regret it for a second. It was an extraordinary experience, humbling beyond imagination. And
because
it was difficult.
Yeah.
Because I ran against a legend in American politics, not just California politics, and I learned an enormous amount in that process, and also got me out all across the state. And I think I'm a much better lieutenant governor for it. And every day I'm learning to a degree that is comedic. I'm getting my PhD. What I learn every day is beyond imagination. And I just feel like, I don't know what it prepares you for in life, but it feels right this moment. And I'm not going to be, I don't want to be something. I want to do something. I want to get something done. And you know, I was, you can love me or hate me, but no one could deny that we came up with a lot of ideas as mayor. And no one could deny, if they look back at those ideas, the success in implementing the overwhelming majority of them. You may not have liked the outcome. It may not have mattered to you. It may have been the wrong focus. But I love public policy. I love ideas. And I think they also make the best politics. And what we're missing in this country and in this state is real debates around ideas. It's process and personality. And it's the worst of local politics. It's the worst of state and federal politics. It's positioning. And it's calculating. What's the point of winning if you can't do anything or you aren't even interested in doing things? Every discussion's default in politics, when you privately sit down with folks, it becomes a political discussion. It may begin as a policy discussion, but it ends almost exclusively as political. There's no song there. And I fret a bit that the next year and a half in American politics, by definition, is just going to be that, because that's the necessary evil of a presidential election, midterm elections. But there's always a presidential election. There's always a midterm election. And that's what we've got to get out of in terms of that rut and start recognizing that we should lose some elections. We should have the courage to actually do what we think is right, even if it's not the right time, so the next person could come along and move the bar even further. And I think the nobility of politics is not longevity. It's actually producing results. It's actually real progress.
Do you think, you know, Obama has, when I was talking to Dianne Feinstein a couple of years ago about Obama, and she said she had never seen the kind of resistance to him that there has been to a president. How much of that do you think is race?
I think some is there, but, you know, look, you know what, I'm going to get in trouble saying this. I went on Bill O'Reilly, and someone showed me, I forgot things are on YouTube. Don't check things out on YouTube. And someone showed me, and I was shocked. I forgot I did this. First of all, that I went on O'Reilly. But I actually said early on that the way we were reacting to the Tea Party was to our peril. You're not going to like this. This is not the talking point that I get from my Democratic folks. But there was an arrogance and a dismissiveness in tone and tenor against the Tea Party early on that I think magnified that movement and amplified that message and voice, which I think is very damaging. As if Democrats were immune to tactically disrupting public events. The audacity of these Tea Party people to come into a crowd like this and stand up and express their point of view in opposition of Obamacare. How dare they? What? This is not democracy coming in. I mean,
they're also packing guns, some of them. I mean, there was some extreme behavior.
Of course, but you want extreme behavior? Come to the town halls I did as mayor. You want extreme behavior? Come on. Are you kidding me?
Those are our crazies.
Right, but the point is, everyone has their crazies. And everyone has the right to be fully expressive. And we have the right to dismiss it, but we shouldn't be so dismissive of their right to be expressive. And, you know, I'm about a party of belief that we should embrace different points of view. I believe we should embrace different races and ethnicities and religions and sexual orientations. About celebrating all our interest differences, but uniting around the things that bind us together. Dr. King talked about. If you believe that, and you believe in freedom of speech and freedom of expression, then why are we so quick to dismiss those that we didn't like because their point of view was different? And so my point is not to agree with the Tea Party, but to disagree with how quick we were to trigger a dismissal, which infuriated people even more. They felt powerless, fearful. Their own lives fearful. They may be attacking a gun for many different reasons. God bless. My dad lives in Dutch Flat, Placer County. I mean, late at night when I hear some coyotes up there, hell, I'm looking for the gun. It's a different environment than living in an urban center. I don't quickly dismiss that either. And we have a record of gun control in this city that I'll put up against any mayor in the United States. The NRA went after San Francisco and Chicago after that famous Supreme Court decision. So it didn't stop me from doing the things I thought were right here. My point is, we have to be cautious about that. So long-winded point to you. The healthcare debate created an environment in an environment of fear and anxiety that already existed, that it was just too much, too soon, too fast. Government's too big. The TARP, the this, the bailout, and the car industry, which none of you thought would actually, I doubt many of you thought would be successful. I mean, we don't, there was that fear in that environment. And then we were dismissive and we were in power. And people felt powerless. And when they feel powerless, they act out. And so I just hope we learned a lesson from that. And I learned a lot of lessons as mayor. I was very dismissive early on when, you know, Chicken George and, you know, the naked guy that was running against me were doing protests and sit-ins at my little town halls around Care Not Cash and other things. And I thought, who are these people? These are nuts, you know. But I learned to be more humble. Say, you know what, this is, you know, I'd read the Bay Guardian. They said, how dare Newsom be so dismissive of these voices? They have every, the tradition of civil rights is civil disobedience. And you know what, they were right. Yet we just think because it's the other side, they're wrong. And I think it's a combination of those things that created this image of Obama as a divider, not a uniter.
Yeah.
And that, I think, we paid a price. And I don't know it's fair to him, but I think we amplified it indirectly, some of the party leadership.
So we're going to take some of your questions in about 5 minutes. If you'd like to ask the lieutenant governor something, there's two microphones here. You can just line up behind one of those, and I'll call on you in just a few minutes.
Defending the Tea Party probably wasn't a great crowd pleaser. I get that. But I hope you understand my point. Yeah. Not defending a point of view, but defending the right to have a point of view.
So you don't think race really has much to do with it?
I think it does. I think for some people it does, but I think it's less that. I don't sense that where I go. I don't think people are, you know, it may subconsciously, but I think we, I'm not saying we, any of us have moved beyond that completely, quite the contrary, but I don't think that's it. I think it's just a very different world we're living in. Look what we went through economically. I don't know who could have been in this position and made the decisions that needed to be made, which were the right decisions that I think the president made, that would have escaped this kind of divide anymore.
Yeah. I just want to ask you a quick question about your being a dad.
Oh, my God.
Montana is how old now?
I wish
three?
I left the phone. I have a picture. I know, God, this sounds like the politician. I hate it when they do this. But I have my daughter.
Christmas cards.
My daughter yesterday going to just preschool, her first day. And I have a picture of her leaning up right over the door, sort of leaning in. And it's a picture behind. And I'm like, it's just, I show everyone I start, you know. I hate sounding like, but it is world-changing, life-changing. It's beyond extraordinary, 23-month-old piece of perfection that kept me up all night last night and woke up at 5 o'clock in our bed, and you break your heart. And I don't want to sound cliche-ish and say it's about the generation, and I'm not there yet maybe, but I'll be in a few years and be that easy cliche, but, oh, man, it puts all of it in perspective. And you know what? Everybody, Tea Party members, right-wing conservatives, left-wing liberals, have the same feelings. They have the same dreams, the same aspirations, the same hopes I do today when my kids go into school, and the same hope and expectation, a positive and optimistic future. And, you know, I know, you know, Obama spoke to that so brilliantly, not red states, blue states, United States. But I kid you not. I mean, you get that in Texas with Republicans, and, you know, as much as I get in Fred, or, you know, in Santa Monica. Just different worldviews in number of issues, but same fundamental core values about just a better life for their kids and their grandkids in the future.
You know, a lot of young couples debate among themselves whether or not to have kids or how many to have. And was that an issue for you? Did you know right away you wanted to have
kids? I didn't know. I knew. I didn't know. You know, you don't know. Oh, my God. You just don't know.
Well, I'm not sure what that means.
It means you don't have kids.
I don't have kids.
You don't have kids. You would know.
You're saying once you've had them, you knew.
Yeah, you just know. I mean, you could say, oh, this will be, I want to get on there and share life. But then you have a kid. It's a deeper spiritual
connection.
Experience in a way that, I love, I told my sister, I said, I love my goddaughter, your daughter, and I love, they're the greatest. But it's a deeper thing than any, all of you know this. You know this if you have a kid. Now, I haven't had teenagers yet. I may have a very different point of view. But you remember those, you know, two, three, and they, you know, daddy, daddy. up, you know, come on. Yeah.
All right, well, let's go to
some of that mushy stuff. Let's get into some hard hitting.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a question about your hair here.
Yeah, let's talk real issues.
Why don't we start over here? And I'll ask everyone to please make it a question, not a speech, and make it concise.
Sure.
Yes. If you want to say your name and where you live, that's fine, too.
My name's Kathy Mishonsky. I'm the director of the Business Council on Climate Change. I don't know if that rings a bell.
Yes, it does.
It's an organization that Gavin Newsom founded when he was mayor of San Francisco. Yeah. So I'm going to recycle a question that I heard Mark Benioff ask Eric Schmidt last week at Dreamforce, which I know you were at, too, and you probably heard him answer. And the question is, what keeps you up at night? And I'm going to add to that, too, why and what are you doing about it?
Oh.
And not Montana, I guess, aside from Montana.
Yeah, well, literally, yeah, she literally does keep me up at night. Yeah, what keeps you up at night? My daughter, thanks. Next question, yeah. You know, what keeps me up at night? Apathy, disengagement, pessimism. I'd argue pessimism is worse than cancer. You know, in a pessimistic world where you're fearful about the future, what do? You hold on to your piece of the pie, to your patch, because you think it's a zero-sum game. And that's what we have now, special interest, also holding on to their thing, which makes it so much more difficult as opposed to the notion of limitlessness and the optimism that comes with that. Think about this. L.A., the second largest city in the United States, had an election a few months ago. 7 city council seats and 10 major ballot initiatives on issues from pensions to keeping libraries open, important stuff. Take a guess how many people, what percent of folks showed up to bother to care. 7 city council races, 10 major ballot issues, country's second largest city.
12%.
88% of registered voters stayed at home or didn't have the willingness to stay at home and fill out an absentee ballot. Now what's remarkable with that is not the number, because it was 13% the previous election. What was remarkable is that there was no headline. There was no story about it. It was just lost in the back of an article. Apathy. People are disconnected. They just don't care. They don't believe. They don't feel they have a stake. They don't feel they have. And why does that matter? Because that's the foundational principle that makes everything possible. And that makes me sleep at night. So what am I trying to do about it? I'm trying to enliven people's senses. I'm trying to you know, try new things. I'm trying to be more authentic. I'm trying to actually say what I say in public, same thing I say in private. I'm trying to be myself and all warts and all. And I'm trying to be audacious and trying to offer something a little bit different and working through and struggling like every other politician. But that's what I'm trying to do.
For our radio audience, I have to say once again, this program is presented by the Commonwealth Club's Inforum, and tonight we're hosting Gavin Newsom, the man, the issues, and the state of California.
Is that written down somewhere?
Yes, it is right there.
Unbelievable.
Right there,
wow.
The man.
Yeah, the man.
I'm Scott Schaefer, host of the California Report on KQED, and let's go to some more questions.
Yeah, yes. Sorry. I'll make quicker answers. There's a lot of them. Yeah.
My name is Kevin, and I work for an environmental nonprofit. I'm very interested to know your thoughts on other states that have started to adapt cell phone safety legislation similar to San Francisco's, and there are quite a few to name, like Oregon and Maine and recently Pennsylvania. And I'm also asking this with a new perspective that the World Health Organization listed cell phones as a possible carcinogen on a list next to DDT, something under our EPA that is now a known carcinogen.
Yeah.
And just, you know, your thoughts on that, since I know you were the first person to really sign this in. You've kind of become a hero to people in this movement.
Yeah, no, this whole thing called SARs, specific absorption rates that all cell phones have. Some have higher specific absorption rates, some have lower. There's actual requirement they can't go above a certain percentage. Why? Because there's some concern that you go above a certain percentage, it may not be healthy. There's a lot of studies around the world, particularly with younger people, people pregnant, et cetera, that there could be some harmful impacts. The industry is paranoid of these and is absolutely vehement that that's nonsense, and they have all their data to prove that it's nonsense. I actually got convinced that there was something to this, and all I said is right to know. I said, I don't know if it's true or not, but I think people have the right to know what this is. It is legally required that the SRR be disclosed, but on websites, page 752 of someone's website. I didn't think that was right. And so I said, if you got a cell phone just at the point of sale where it says, you know, $24.99, AT&T, just have a thing that says SAR, you know, 2.3 or whatever it is. The industry came down hard on us. They actually canceled their conference here in San Francisco. I was running for higher office. Trust me, it's not an industry you want to infuriate. I'm a big believer in technology. I'm writing a book about this, technology, social media. And I use my iPhone. I love it, and I'm not encouraging you not to or discouraging you. But I just think you have a right to know about this, so the question's a good one. And we got a lot of grief, a lot of blowback, and I'm still paying a big price for that. And those are little things, right? I mean, that's not a headline. That's not something that's not, you know, we have famous. But, you know, I just think it was important because I see what, look, special interest on both sides, guys. Trust me. My side is as good with special interest money as some of the others. It's not just all big business writing big checks. There are a lot of folks on our side. It may not be as many with the new Supreme Court decision in the future, and that's something we all should concern ourselves with. But they buy silence. They buy apathy. They buy politicians.
They like the status quo.
They love this. And again, in a pessimistic and fearful environment, you're going to fight for your patch. It's a zero-sum game. Yeah. You don't know about what's going to happen in the future. You got to hold on your own. And I think, you know, if you want fundamental change as opposed to playing in the margins and just hiring new people and they have all these promises and you're let down, disappointed, and then, you know, then it's going to require some folks to get out front. And maybe we're wrong. But maybe we're right. And I like to think San Francisco has always been a city, of, as they say, of dreamers and doers, of entrepreneurs and innovators, always on the leading cutting edge. And California is the same.
Okay.
Coast of dreams.
Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, my name's Carly Schwartz. I'm the editor of Huffington Post San Francisco.
Congratulations.
Well, thank you. We just launched last month.
Yes.
I hope you check us out.
Please
and
do.
And we
everyone.
Did feature your blog, which we were very excited about, so
yeah.
Thank you for that.
Yeah, it was one comment. Wasn't that
I was wondering what you miss most about living in San Francisco and what you miss least about
Guys, I haven't moved out of the city. I mean, a temporary visa at parents-in-law. We're out
but
of town with
to
a
know.
New baby.
These are the important questions.
I'm here every day. My office is here. My businesses are here. My family's here. I'm actually here with you now. I'll be here tomorrow.
And yet you're not sleeping here. We want to know.
Oh, I know.
Oh, that, don't go there.
Exciting. Yeah,
don't
no, right. There. It's hard to miss when I get home at 9, 10 o'clock at night anyway and wake up first thing in the morning and I'm here all the time. I don't know that I miss much except some of the car noise out front of Masonic, which is where I was living before, right on the edge of the street. But I'm an urban kid. I grew up in an urban environment. I love this city. It's in my DNA. I did spend time in Marin in high school. So that was one of the reasons it was easy for me to go back with my wife, who grew up there as well. And they're not aliens out there. Marin's not so strange. A lot of progressive folks out there.
They have a ban on nudity there, too.
Do they actually?
Yeah, they do.
They're tougher on nudity than we are. Well, that's something to consider.
I hear you're moving to L.A. sometime.
Yeah, I'm doing that, too. That's in Brown's column. You don't always believe what you read. I'll repeat that. Don't always believe what you read. I have no idea where that came from either. I don't know why everyone cares so much. You should care about my point of view on higher education more than whether or not the lieutenant governor who represents 37 million people throughout the state is actually living in one city or the other. It's probably good to get out of one city and get to the rest of the state. You should be asking me, are you moving to Bakersfield or Imperial Valley, which unemployment's at 30.8% in Imperial County. 30.8%. There are 21 counties with unemployment north of 15%. There are 2.167 million people unemployed in this state. We're at 12%, non-seasonally adjusted 12.4%, the second highest in the United States of America. You think we got a crisis at 9%, Mr. President? Come out to California at 12%. Explain to the folks in Imperial County that are 30.8%, not underemployment, raw unemployment number, what a crisis really means. This is serious stuff. You've been to Lost Hills? Near Bakersfield, among the highest teen pregnancy rates. You got the highest concentration of poverty. You got people working 60 hours a week with no overtime pay and 110-degree weather right now with no health care. That's legally sanctioned in the United States of America for farm workers earning minimum wage. And that's your country, our country. That's the richest state in the richest democracy God's ever conceived. I mean, I think maybe every damn politician should go to these areas. Why don't we? Because they don't vote for us. That's the Reddit. Why are you up in Fresno doing a town hall meeting? They're never going to vote for you. As Democrats, everything we're about is out there in the Central Valley. Everything we claim to care about is out there in the Central Valley. The question should be, why aren't Democrats like me living out in the Central Valley?
Yes.
Great, thank you. I'll just follow it up with that same jobs theme. So my name's Josh Meter, by the way. I own a small business in Santa Cruz, California, just down the road from the university.
Just got a tax cut from the president. Congrats.
Oh, thank you.
You're going to hire? Well, are you hiring now?
That's my question, yeah. People look to the president as, you know, somehow he's going to, you know, wave this magic fiscal wand and get consumers to start spending, or he's going to convince corporations to start investing, start hiring people. But I really believe it's the small businesses in the communities that make the decision to hire the busboy at Starbucks or add another shift at the pizza parlor or whatever have you. So my question is, you know, what would you say to all those small businesses that are a huge engine of California's economy to, you know, give them hope that, you know, California is a great place to hire and work and send your kids to public school?
Yeah, let me just quickly, I'm happy to stay all night. I know we can turn off the radio and keep talking. I'm serious, because this is a profoundly important question. There's no soundbite 30-second answer in this. But let me just underscore this. Here's some interesting facts. And the California numbers have been updated. The last numbers, they came out nationally with the updated numbers yesterday. California's about to get the updated number. But the last numbers we have show about 3.5 million businesses in California. Three quarters don't have any employees. I'll repeat that. All but 897,000 of those businesses have no employees. It's not small business. It's not even micro business. I mean, this is the picture of business startups in this state. It has been in the past. Now, nationally, it went from 16 million, dropped to 14 million. There are five-year updates. It'll be interesting to see where we went from 3.5 where we are today in California. When you hear Fox News lamenting, oh, this millionaire, you know, if they increase the top tier, it will hurt small business. Who the hell are they talking about? You're a small business person. Pat Kelly is my employee at Plum Jack Wine. We aren't going to be impacted by that. You are the economy in this country. You're the only one creating jobs. All the net new jobs. Kauffman Foundation came out. They scoped and scrubbed all the job growth. It only came from small business the last few decades. Big business cuts jobs. But who do we appoint on every one of our jobs councils? Some big business rep who's in the job of cutting jobs. Who is on Meet the Press? People that are in the business of cutting jobs. And they're advising people like me, I guess, on how to cut more jobs. Because I don't know how they could be advising us on how to create jobs when they're not creating them. It's guys like this, and they're never part of that national discussion. So our plan dominantly focuses on microloans, focuses on microlending, focuses on small business development, focuses on regulation in this respect, permits. You don't have to deal with CEQA, I bet. You can care less about
CEQA.
No
idea what that is.
Exactly. But you think in California, some of my friends on the other side of the aisle say, well, we just got to get rid of CEQA, and all of a sudden businesses will boom. I told you, 17 businesses, 15, I didn't have to deal with CEQA. We got close to 1,000 jobs without having to deal with CEQA.
CEQA, California Environmental Quality Act.
Yeah, yeah. It means nothing to someone who's got a lousy city council member put some lousy rule in Santa Cruz and made it impossible for him to have someone inspect his upgrade of his bathroom for ADA. That's what matters, is the permit. And then your county board of supervisors and what they do. And so our plan talks about supporting small business from a permitting environment, not just a CEQA environment. We talk this language at 36,000 feet that has no connection truly to the real world. It's laughable. And you let us get away. You keep reelecting us. So, I mean, shame on all of us. It's a stunning thing. So we have a whole agenda on that. And the new bill, long-winded point, but this important. The bill that's on the governor's desk includes a small business advocate and this new economic development agency that Speaker Perez has put together. And we're going to make this the top priority in the state of California, supporting you and supporting cities and counties and their local economic development efforts.
All right, let's try to get one more question in here. We're short on time.
Good. I'll do quick yes-nos.
Yeah. An open-ended question.
Uh-oh.
What does your authentic self think about the fact that here in San Francisco, quasi-government agency BART turned off cell phone service in order to thwart the protest.
Quick answer. Come on. You asked me that. It scares the heck out of me because that's stuff I read overseas in China. That's stuff I'm hearing, you know, out in the Middle East. I get people came to the fence, said it's a security issue, and I guess you can make an argument, but that scares the heck out of me. It just does.
What do you think of the protests? They shut down BART again today.
Oh, amen. Hey, look, as long as you're not hurting other people, as long as you're being respectful for other people's rights to go about their day-to-day life, I'm all for people sharing their point of view. And again, I don't have to, I don't know what happened today. I happen to be with those few Democratic lieutenant governors touring around. But
I think there is a lot of frustration on the part of commuters because I think they do feel that they've been interrupting.
Yeah.
You think that's just like, hey, that's life, that's life.
No, I said the opposite. I said, I don't like it.
No.
Oh, I said, Scott, just the opposite. No, I don't like it. So that's my point of view.
Oh, so you think the protesters are wrong?
Well, people were protesting saying, shut off my cell phones?
Well, I think they sort of came later, and there was
okay,
we don't want to go into
I don't, it, you know what, this is,
more speech is better than less.
No, I think people have the right to use their cell phone to call their family and check in on their son or daughter or check in on their parents. I just happen to think wherever you are, you should have the right to do that. And I get a little nervous when someone behind the scenes is making a decision to deny you that right because they subjectively feel it's the right thing to do. Now, there are extraordinary circumstances, I'm not naive, where I do think it's appropriate. BART has made the case it was an extraordinary circumstance. It was about public safety, and I have to be responsive and respectful to that. But as a general rule, I believe people should have the freedom of privacy, freedom to know that when they're using technology, it's used to protect their privacy and their health, and that they have the confidence and freedom to know that what they have paid for works. And the ability to communicate with an essential tool now, and that's mobile technology, and connect with other people.
Yeah. So we've come to what I think is probably your favorite part.
The lightning round?
Yeah. No. Even better. We're asking all of our speakers, and by say we, I mean the Commonwealth Club, the following question: Gavin, what is your 60-second idea to change the world?
Yeah, I can't even fake
50
the fact
seconds.
He
left.
Didn't. Yeah, good. Yeah, keep going. What are we down to? So I always say, Scott mentioned that literally as we're walking in. They said, hey, we're going to ask you this. We ask everyone. And I said, world peace. I feel like I'm on the pageant show or something. You know, and
Miss America.
Carrie Prezon or something, you know, or whatever the heck her name was. Remember, she's the one who was against gay marriage. Miss California or something. The one thing to change the world, I just talked about engagement. Look, I think the one thing to change the world is empathy. I'm for empathy. I'm for empathetic people, even in the political debate, and I hope I demonstrated that by actually trying to explain my point of view about people I totally disagree with that happen to associate with a party, the Tea Party. Empathy. I think people need to be other people oriented. I mentioned quickly, I said, we need to seek first to understand before we're understood. I think it'd be nice to start listening again. A little less ideological. So damn sure our way is the only way. And I think in a world that is so interdependent, where there's no leak on your side of the boat, we're all in this together, that there's no more important principle and value than empathy and the capacity to understand and appreciate, learn from. You don't have to necessarily follow other people.
All right. Gavin Newsom, thanks so much for being here tonight.
Thank you.
And now this meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club is officially adjourned.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you. That was a great answer.
Thanks, Scott.
That was a great answer. Oh, thanks.